And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us and sticking with us. Because we're going to get down to, as you guys all know, same every week, my favorite part of the show. We've got our old macro advisor, our macroeconomics specialist with us, Mr. Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro, the new father and macro guru. Chase, how in the heck are things, man?
No, things are good down here in SoCal now that, at least in SoCal, most of our fires are gone and it's not 110 degrees.
Oh, yeah, that 110's a little bit, that's a little bit toasty, huh?
Indeed.
Not, that's not exactly sitting by the pool weather.
No.
No, no, it's too hot for that. Okay, man, plenty to talk about. And I really don't have anything specific I want to hit on. Just, I'm laughing a little bit. You and I had a conversation. We've had multiple conversations about it, and I think we did it one of the times we talked, where we said, "Look, we think that the macro shakeout of this thing is you've turned the economy off, you're going to turn it back on, and just by default turning it back on, you're going to see these big jumps, and then the aggressive talk of V-shaped recoveries is going to commence, right?" And then I think we even said you're going to see some tweets from Trump about record jobs numbers and all this kind of stuff. And literally, now we got to see the way it plays out, but literally, and I'm not sticking my chest out here. We get plenty wrong, but we were pretty dead right on that, weren't we? I mean, that's exactly what's happened, is it not?
Yeah, definitely. And the last part you're talking about there is, you know, when we have 20%+ growth numbers popping up, you know, that getting hammered during the election time is going to be, that's still in our future, but they'll definitely use that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Best jobs growth, of all time. We're just going to ignore that we lost record amounts. Right. And then what are we seeing in the data right now? A lot of the data that I'm looking at, and I know that, you know, just clients out there that are listening, we're paying attention to macro data, but that's one of the reasons we work with Chase, because he's watching it, you know, in detail all the time. A lot of the numbers look to me, maybe rolling over is the wrong term, but and another shout out to you, and I've said this multiple times, the quote unquote shape of this recovery is increasingly looking like a square root. Is it? I mean, is that what you're seeing? Is that continued, or are you surprised by the strength of the? Where are we at?
Yeah, to me, it still is a square root. I think, you know, you expected it to spike back up, but what happened after that was going to be important. And we've kind of flatlined, rolled over in some areas. Everyone has their own letter to describe the recovery. And one that does kind of make sense to me is a K-shaped recovery, people are calling it, where like there are some parts of, you know, the economy and some people that are doing great, and there are some parts and people that are doing terrible. And I think that's really true. A lot of people are, you know, paying down a lot of debt all of a sudden, you know, people that, if you can work from home easily and you still have your white collar job, then, you know, it's easy. You can pay even more bills now because you're not, you know, spending money on gas and things like that. But at the same time, you know, there's 28 million people getting unemployment benefits right now. There are cities where you're starting to see furniture pile up in the streets because so many people are getting evicted. So there's a lot of bifurcation, you know, going on in the recovery that, you know, is going to have plenty of economic consequences as well as probably political consequences because where we're at in the election cycle.
Okay, now you brought up something that I wanted to talk about specifically because I've heard you say that. I thought we have a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures.
Yeah, so congressionally we had that, you know, inside of the CARES Act, and that rolled off at the same time that the extended unemployment benefits did at the end of July. Trump did pass an executive order. So he passed, you know, that slew of executive orders, and it sounded great. It sounded like, hey, everyone still gets, you know, a bunch of unemployment money. You still can't get evicted. But if you actually looked under the surface, so, you know, the kind of the legal reality of everything that was passed there, it was, well, I've been calling it a nothing burger because that's what it was. All he basically did was ask, you know, federal agencies to take a look, hard look into what they should do about evictions. It does not ban evictions federally. So that is still perfectly fine legally from a federal standpoint. And there are certain states and localities that do still have those in place, but there are 20, 30 million people right now that are at risk of being evicted. And there's currently nothing really powerful enough in place federally to stop that. So, and this is, you know, this is something
so
I was
on,
saying.
Hold on. So that executive order that Trump just issued, it doesn't have any teeth. There is effectively
correct.
No moratorium.
That is correct.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Okay. So, yeah. So kind of a window dressing type deal.
100%. All of those executive orders were window dressing. The unemployment benefits extension, where they were going to pay the $300 only, at the beginning of this week, only two states were even doing that. Now it's five states. A bunch of states are saying they're not even going to do it. Part of that was that they were going to get states to kick in an extra $100 to make it work. And basically every state said, that's cool. We don't have any money, so we're not doing that. And that was only five. There was only 5 weeks worth of money to even support the unemployment benefits from the executive order. So essentially that whole thing it was all for show, really. And a lot of people have said, hey, that's a really smart political move because it makes it look like Congress won't do anything. So the president, you know, just did it all himself. But the problem is, you know, and there's a lot of regular people out there that saw the headlines and said, oh, cool. Like I can't get evicted and I'm going to keep getting a bunch of money for unemployment. And they made life decisions based on that. And then all of a sudden they realized like, oh, that wasn't real. That was more of a headline, you know, and that's having real impacts on people. So, and at the same time, what that did was it gave Congress an excuse to not pass like a real new, like major stimulus package, because they could sit back and say, oh, well, you know, we had the executive order, so we don't have to be in a big rush to do anything. And I think that's the way it's played out is you had some urgency in Congress to get another round of fiscal stimulus passed and all just vaporized whenever those executive orders hit. So now, you know, we have now been a month into having all the unemployment benefits gone and the eviction moratorium gone, and you're starting to see the impact of that.
Is it showing up in any of the numbers that we're seeing? My whole thought was if they didn't get that renewed, you would see an immediate contraction in consumer spending. Are we seeing that?
You are starting to see a bit of a roll over there, but I think that will still take, you know, a couple more weeks to really start showing up. But you can see it, how much money is being paid out unemployment wise, and it's down about $15 billion a week over the last month. And if you annualize that, that's $720 billion a year. So that is a lot of money that has been just pulled out of the economy. So you are going to start seeing, you know, millions of people losing their apartments and their homes.
Well, yeah, you've got to be sitting there looking. That's got to be right around right around 4%. 4% of the size of the economy, that reduction in unemployment benefits.
Yeah, do the math, but yeah, it's I mean, it's massive. You're getting close to $1 trillion annualized. You know,
right, right. Okay, so here's what I don't understand. So hopefully you can shed some light on this. Do politicians not understand the gravity of the situation economically? Maybe they're being, you know, I think you and I would both agree that you know, and it's hard to see inside their minds. I just know you're looking at these kind of things, so maybe you don't have an answer, but just anything, you know, any light you could shed on it. I'm just wondering if stock market performance, equity performance is, you know, it's clearly influencing, you know, the vast public, the investor public, into thinking that this is a much more robust recovery than is actually taking place. I'm just wondering if politicians are believing that, because I am sitting here scratching my head. Now, and listeners know, I think, where you and I both sit on the aisle. I mean, you know, we are not a pro intervention to this level. You know, we've said all along throughout this cycle that the Fed was going to paint themselves into a corner. That's exactly what has happened. At the same time, you and I both know that if you stop this flow of unemployment and stimulus, this whole thing craters. I'm just sitting here shocked right now that Trump isn't freaking out more and stomping his feet more, because if he doesn't get those unemployment claims out and he doesn't get that money going out, this thing is going to crater right before the election, isn't it?
Absolutely, it will. And it's a major risk to his reelection, I think. I think his executive orders were a blunder, a political blunder, like of the sort that honestly normally doesn't come out of the White House. I think, you know, what depending on whether you agree or disagree with a lot of the policies and sentiment, like they're usually pretty savvy politically. And I think personally, they probably on this one kind of got played by Nancy Pelosi. I think she I think she got the best of them on this one. Whether they viewed it as they had to do the executive orders, just to get something out there because they didn't think anything was going to pass no matter what, then from that standpoint, yeah, I guess it's better than nothing. But, you know, I think they removed not only the urgency from the other side of the aisle, but from especially the Senate GOP, because Senate GOP was already just really hesitant to pass, you know, any major bill. The Democrats passed $3.5 trillion. The Republicans couldn't even pass a $1 trillion bill in the Senate. They never even passed one.
Chase, between you and I was completely gobsmacked that they didn't jump all over that $3.5 trillion and do it.
So I agree with you from a number standpoint. And I think, you know, that would have been, to me, that would have been kind of a savvy political play to like, oh yeah, that's cool, we'll just pass that. And because then, you know, the economy would have boomed, and I think that would have really crushed their chances of winning in the election. But they made it such a kind of left-wing wish list of spending that that was just unpalatable, you know, with so much green spending and things like that, that, you know, a lot of traditional Republicans just weren't going to get down with.
So the Democrats, to their credit, they are playing chess. They said, okay, we'll pass your stimulus bill, but we're going to load it up with a bunch of things that we know you can't stomach. So then you're going to go down as the guys that voted no on the stimulus bill.
Yeah, and the two sides have come nowhere close to really meeting in the middle on this thing. Both sides want the other side to come really far towards them. the only way this can even work right now is if the White House and Pelosi and Schumer make a deal, and then they just shove it down the Senate GOP's throat and pass it by one vote. That is the only way this is really going to work out. And to this point, you know, we haven't even come close to that. They're barely even talking right now.
Okay, so now what's the story? Where are we at? And just so, again, I want to reemphasize this, that do not think that I am advocating a $3.5 trillion stimulus bill, right? Chase and I are simply saying that people need to wake up to the fact that if you are hoping for a government to leave their hands off of this and a healthy, robust, normal recovery, you know, I've got a bridge to sell you. That ain't going to happen. Right. If they don't pump the stimulus, you will see a crater, probably, you know, not down to the bottom of where we were at the shutdown, but probably approaching it. You know, you would have don't you believe that, Chase? I mean, do you think I'm off by saying that you would have another like a double dip type scenario if you don't keep the stimulus going? Right.
Oh, yeah. Big time. So we are going to get a double dip. I think that's pretty much baked in at this point, but it could be a really big one without another, you know, just massive round of stimulus. And eventually we'll get something. And I've been really surprised that the market's totally ignored this to this point. Very surprised.
But I think that what's happened though, is you've just disconnected here, you know, meaning that the euphoria, you know, we needed, you know, shoot, even 5 months ago, right? Even 3 months ago, you needed reasons to keep it rolling. I think this boulder is just rolling down the cliff at this point. You know what I mean? Like, as far as the market's going, I just think that it doesn't really need anything at this moment. I mean, I think it's going to hit a wall, but you know, the momentum of the market is begetting more momentum.
It's its own thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's gone. It's gone postal. Okay, so, and speaking of which, while we're sitting here talking, S&P has crossed above 3,500, 3,506. Where are we at as far as, so is the sequence of events then, what I wanted to ask you is this: where does the $1.8 trillion that is sitting on the Treasury's balance sheet, where does that play into all this?
So it's down to like closer to like 1.5, 1.6 now. And like half of that's earmarked just to like forgiving PPP loans. And so really that number isn't as big as people think. And it's going to get drawn down. Some of it is kind of set aside and earmarked for the next round of stimulus, but hey, if you don't pass anything, you don't get to spend it. So I think the TGA is getting a little bit too much, just attention. And I, to me, it's priced in. Like, everyone knows it's there. Anyone that looked carefully, you know, they kind of know where it's headed. So I'm not paying as much attention to it as I was, I don't know, like call it a month ago, personally. I'm paying more attention to the fiscal side and just some other data that we're starting to see in the economy that people aren't paying attention to that's going to matter.
Well, are you saying that facts are going to matter at some point again?
Yeah. So speaking of, there's something I want to highlight. I'll just talk about it now just so I don't forget. And that's what we're seeing is like a lot of credit deteriorating in the, like for real people, regular folks out there. So what's funny is, you know, whenever this fiscal stimulus rolled off, nobody in the market cared. Obviously, Congress doesn't seem to care enough to do anything about it. But who is caring is banks. So whenever banks realized the gravy train was, you know, going to get stopped for a little bit, they're tightening up credit lines, whether it's credit cards, just chopping people's, you know, credit limits down, even up like 80-90%, I've heard. Maybe your credit card said you could spend 50 grand. Now it says, hey, like you got 5 grand. Because they know a lot of people don't have a job and they don't have income and they're liable to just run up their credit card, you know, all the way to the max and just not pay it back. So you're starting to see that. You're seeing, just the standards get tightened up for credit. So a lot of people that want to get a mortgage that, you know, if it's not a good guaranteed mortgage, it's just not going to happen. Revolving loans, so you know, it's kind of consumer credit loans. Those are, if you don't have perfect credit and can't prove you have a job that's probably stable, you're not getting a loan. So that's going to start having a really big macro impact. Usually there's about a 2-quarter lag on that, and then all of a sudden you'll see retail sales just kind of implode. So even Q1 2021, I think you should start seeing the consumer start to look really bad and retail sales roll over, which means obviously earnings are going to take a probably bigger hit than anyone expects. And, you know, I feel like you and I have been saying, hey, like earnings are going to be worse than people expect for about 6 months now. And to this point, we've been right. They've been brutal and they've blown out all those early expectations, even early on in the pandemic. And I just think it's going to keep deteriorating.
Yeah. I mean, it sure seems that way. Okay. So are we going to see another stimulus bill prior to the election? I guess it really depends on what happens politically, but I'm just wondering, like I said to you earlier, I don't want to circle back on this and review it, but I'm just trying to wrap my head around right now what is going on in the Trump White House and why they aren't responding to this. Is there a way for them to get more funds out there without congressional approval? Is there a way for them to end around it? Do you think they understand the gravity, or do you think, like I was alluding to earlier, or do you think they're kind of being anesthetized by the market as well and thinking that this is going much better than, because it really is. And Chase, I, you know, again, I've been accused of being too negative, and I always push that back because I go, look, you know, when you're in this business, I think to be negative or positive is an error in and of itself, meaning that I want to see things the way they are in an unbiased fashion. And I'm looking at this whole scenario, kind of scratching my head, wondering why they're not freaking out more, why they're not more dedicated to, you know, trying to get that money out there or fed it. Maybe they are. Maybe we're just not hearing it. But it seems like everybody's sort of, you know, I don't know, like asleep at the wheel. And then I'm listening to these people, these market commentators talk about, you know, this bounce back is even stronger than we thought and all this. And I'm looking at them going, you know, I don't know what data you guys are looking at. I mean, you have had that initial surge that you and I said, just by, like I said, you know, just as a ramification of just turning the economy back on. But, I'm not seeing the strength that everybody's talking about. Am I looking in the wrong place, or are there pockets, like you said, it's kind of K-shaped. Are there pockets of strength outside of large tech companies?
Yeah. I mean, home builders, you know, have been just incredible. As well as the lumber to make them. But yeah, I mean, there are definitely pockets, but what I think is happening really is people just get so influenced by market prices. So I think when people see, hey, the stock market ripping and, you know, investment grade bonds are doing great, they just kind of, it just dulls your senses to reality, you know, kind of underlying that. So I think that's largely what's happening. If you look at, like, obviously the Fed's out there buying, you know, Berkshire Hathaway bonds and Apple bonds. And so investment grade bonds are doing great. But if you look at CCC rated, the default rate on those is 40% right now. I mean, that's, there's a lot of data that's depressionary, right? But it's getting ignored because, hey, the S&P is up again, so everything's probably fine. You know, no need to dig deep if the S&P is up. So it's very bifurcated. And I think that is, you know, it's making it difficult for people that aren't willing to dig deep into all these different indicators and numbers to try to figure out what's really going on. And just going back to your question about, like, hey, the White House, like, what are they thinking here with the fiscal stimulus? I'm struggling with that. And I think, as has happened so often in this White House, you have, you know, all these different advisors around the president, and typically in his White House, they all have their own opinions. And I think that's probably honestly a good thing, but it seems like the Treasury Secretary and his wife and his chief of staff have kind of taken this over, the as far as the discussions with the Democrats. And his chief of staff is kind of an old school Republican that does not want to spend money. And I think his personal feelings about this have really kind of limited the White House urgency on it. Trump himself capped, you know, his own view of this at $1 trillion. And the Democrats have, you know, made it clear, like, we're not doing a bill for $1 trillion. It's going to be higher than that, just full stop, because they want to give $1 trillion to state and local governments. So there's your trillion without even doing, you know, anything on unemployment. But I, at the same time, I feel like they have to know, you know, they have to be looking at the data and realizing, like, hey, if we don't do fiscal stimulus here, like, we're in big trouble, especially Trump. He loves to spend money. I guarantee he wants to spend a bunch more. Well, so I would think their urgency has to ratchet up. But, you know, once you get under 2 months, if you're the Democrats, what is your incentive to do it other than, you know, caring about the economy and people? But I feel like they're willing to eat 2 months of pain to possibly, you know, win 4 years of power.
Yeah, no, it, you know what, Chase, it's a really bizarre deal because and we've talked about this, you and I have, some, you know, pretty much since the beginning, but it continues to amaze me. Well, there's a lot of things that amaze me right now, but it continues to amaze me the casual nature which so many people seem to view this. It seems like their attitude was, or is, and it doesn't seem, I've heard many of them say this, many Mark commentators, that look, this was a, there was nothing wrong with the economy, which you and I both know is not true. And that the economy was booming and it was healthy, and this was a self-inflicted wound. And because of that, we'll get right back on the horse and just carry on the way things were. I'm shocked to hear that because regardless, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, you know, friendly fire, right? I got hit by friendly fire, therefore it's not going to be fatal, right? Well, it doesn't matter who fired the gun. The damage has been done. Like you were talking about, 40% default rates, evictions shooting up, bankruptcies skyrocketing. You know, that disconnect of people thinking, well, it's a self-inflicted wound, so we can get right back on the horse. And you go, well, it doesn't matter who lit the fuse, right? It doesn't matter who pulled the trigger. The damage has been done. What do you assign? What do you attribute that disconnect to? Is it just fascination and preoccupation with, you know, Fed juicing things and stimulus or what? I continue in a way that makes me constantly check myself and ask myself, am I looking at this in the wrong way? Why do I not see that argument? And should I? What do you attribute that disconnect to?
I mean, I think it's just, you know, staring at the S&P. I really do. I think if you look at your portfolio and it's going up and everything's good, people just don't look deep enough. And so I think these narratives kind of catch hold and they just become the truth, and everyone just holds on to them until they're just obviously wrong. And people, I think people still think we have fiscal and monetary stimulus on massive scale, and we actually have neither at the moment. So really, this market is kind of on its own, but like you said, the momentum has become its own momentum, and it's going to feed on itself until it burns itself out. But the support structure, I mean, the economy is terrible. The fiscal stimulus situation just unraveled, and the monetary side is also pretty bad at the moment, because, you know, we have to issue more and more treasuries, and the Fed actually hasn't been buying that many of them on a relative or net basis lately. So even the monetary stimulus isn't really there. So it's definitely interesting. But I think, you know, people choose to kind of filter out and check out the good news. So people would rather say, hey, look, man, look how good the housing market's doing. Zillow tells me my house is up 50 grand, you know, since this started. That can't be bad. And I think, you know, people think that's just, you know, Joe Sixpack that thinks that way. But people on Wall Street think they fall into the same traps that we all do whenever we look at things too simplistically like this. And speaking of looking at it too simplistically, I'm always talking about, you know, how the market is a complex adaptive system the economy is, and how it's not linear, and you can't view it as linear. And I think we're, you know, falling into that trap that we always do as humans of and viewing it all as linear. And we're not seeing all the side effects of, you know, millions of people losing their jobs and their homes, and what that will, you know, what that ends up doing to demand. And, you know, if you lose your income, that you're probably going to hurt someone else's income if you don't buy anything from their restaurant or their shop anymore. And so those feedback loops are really starting to gain steam. So those are going to build their own momentum, and that momentum will become its own momentum the way the stock market is right now. And, you know, that's why the fiscal stimulus part is kind of a really big deal. The CARES Act kept from having all those feedback loops start feeding on themselves in a really destructive manner. And now we just kind of pulled it away, and now we're allowing those really bad feedback loops to kind of just start feeding on themselves.
So and you and I have talked about this a little offline, and I want to be very clear when I say this. You know, we have been looking at this, and I think we've said it repeatedly, that you know, as long as the spigots are running full tilt, there really is no limit to how high this thing can go. But for all intents and purposes, at least as far as the extraordinary measure aspect of it all goes, that spigot has essentially been turned off, correct? That's what you're telling us.
Yeah, at the moment, the fiscal monetary stimulus is not a helping, not at all.
Okay. So to me, especially based on the market action we are seeing, this thing looks absolutely ripe for some gyrations here. This looks, I mean, seasonally too, right? Going into September, October, November, not great months for investing. Euphoria could not be more high. I don't know if you saw this, but you now have a scenario where the put call ratio is at an all-time low.
Right.
It's never
no one's taking, no one's getting protection out there. Yeah.
No. And for those people at home, what that means is that the put call ratio is a wonderful way to look at investor sentiment. And when the put call ratio is that low, what it means is that everybody is buying calls. Nobody is buying puts, meaning that everybody expects it to go up. That ratio is at an all-time low. So basically, market sentiment by that metric has never been higher. Now, there's other ways to look at market sentiment, so I don't want to be over the top. But this all, I mean, the only hesitation I have is just because of how crazy this has been. But man, does this feel like you're setting up a perfect stage to go into some serious volatility coming back, at least in the short run. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And you mentioned put call ratio. That's something I've paid a lot of attention to lately. I'm going to get into like the way it all works, but people can check it out. Squeeze Metrics runs, something called like the dark index. And it's kind of a good way to track divergences in the market. And it has been going lower, lower, lower as the S&P has been going higher lately. That's kind of a nice little signal, and it can be helpful at times. There are definitely some positioning and sentiment indicators, that are kind of blowing out lately. People that like to get into all the nerdy option stuff, gamma is becoming something that's kind of becoming a little bit of a warning signal. So you're starting to see all these extremes pop up. Notably here this week, you started to see volatility not really go down, even with the market rallying. That there's a lot of divergences like this that are starting to pop up. And like you said, hey, you know, going into the fall is usually when you get a lot of problems in the market. Last year, everyone expected huge pain in the fall. Everyone was bearish. It's hard to remember now, but everyone was bearish going into the fall. And I made a big case, a big bull case, like, no, everyone's wrong. We're about to go higher. And I like to fade that because everyone thinks you're going to have problems in the fall. But this year, you know, no one seems worried. And so I'm probably going to write up a big piece on why I think we're going to have problems this fall.
Boy, though, you know, this is where it does get tough. And I think that I think for people listening to this show or people, you know, just watching markets in general, especially for those retail guys that sit there and go, you know, why do people get caught in these bubbles? Why don't they get out? Why don't they just sell when things go awry? You know, well, I think that right now is such a great teaching moment, right? Because everything you are looking at as a money manager is telling you, put on the brakes, right? This is, and yet you've been thinking that for the last 6 months. And this thing has gone on a historic rip.
Absolutely.
The only thing making me not just jump into this, and we are adding protection and pulling some off, but not in a super aggressive way, because it is that is a train that is scary to jump in front of. If we play here, do you attribute it to the pullback in the stimulus? Is that the number one thing that's convincing you that we're going to see some volatility, some gyration start up here in the next few weeks, maybe next couple months? Why do you think that will disrupt this meteoric parabolic market rise?
Yeah, so in my opinion, it is the number one thing. There's a lot of things that are starting to make me think that. And to be clear, I haven't been, doing much outright shorting or anything like that. It's just too dangerous. I have been buying a lot of volatility lately, specifically out in the December futures contracts to avoid, short term getting run over. But yeah, it is the fiscal stimulus side. And so that's because, in my opinion, that's everything now. Monetary stimulus really takes a backseat. And at this point, monetary stimulus is essentially just a functionary role. They're just there to print whatever Congress is going to spend. Unfortunately, that's our reality. So like I've said before, everyone still is a Fed watcher and they need to be a Congress watcher. But the reality is no one's doing that. It's funny, some of the reporters that I follow, some of the people in DC that are, really in the trenches on this fiscal side and, talking to the people in Congress, they're kind of just shocked by how much Wall Street has ignored the reality in DC and how bad the situation is on the fiscal side. There have been, and I've seen it myself with, the investment research coming out of, the big investment banks, where they're treating, and they've been doing this for 2 months, where they're treating it as just totally a slam dunk that you're going to get $2 trillion stimulus imminently. And they've been saying that for 2 months, and here we are. We've already spent an entire month without it, and then still Wall Street's like, oh yeah, well, they'll do it in any second now, and we've gotten nothing. And just, I think that's the biggest reason the market hasn't paid attention to it is because your average institutional investor, especially, saying like, oh yeah, well they'll get around to it. And I've been telling some friends lately, we used to have like a Pavlovian response to stimulus where, the Fed rang the bell and then the market drooled. But now the market drools before they even ring the bell. So it's almost like Congress and the Fed are waiting for the market to have a big pullback to really do anything. But at this point, it kind of looks like the market's like, yeah, well, we know you'll get around to it, So we're not even going to wait for the bell to drool. And that really kind of, changes the game theory for how policymakers may have to start treating these things. If the market isn't even going to go down because they know the stimulative response will eventually come.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it has to.
That's weird. And the market knows that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but here's the thing, the thing that concerns me, about that going forward is that, and this is not a political statement at all. You've got a party that has virtually zero incentive to pass anything meaningful between now and the election, right? The tweet put out by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I don't think got nearly as enough press as it should have. I think it was only up for like 30 seconds and she deleted it. Somebody screen snapped it though. And did you see that where she said we should just keep this thing locked down before the election and keep the stimulus rolling so the people are okay, but basically bring the economy to a halt because that will help us get Trump out of office. Did you see that tweet?
I actually did not see that. I missed that.
Yeah. She only had it up for, it was probably up for like 15, 25 seconds. And you knew that that's exactly what they were thinking, right? Behind the scenes.
Right.
Yet at the same time to hear somebody say it was like, whoa, I can't believe she admitted that. So I'm kind of looking at right now going, I don't think you may not get a stimulus bill passed prior to the election. Where 2 months ago I was with you, I thought it was a foregone conclusion. But watching this starting to play out politically, I'm kind of scratching my head thinking, this may not happen. They don't have any incentive to do this. And the moral – the moral authority I think that the left feels to get Trump out of office usurps any sense of duty to the economy, because I think that they truly believe that there is no price too high, right? There is no price too big to pay to get Trump out of office. Is that kind of the feeling you're getting as well?
Yeah, everything you just said totally makes sense to me. And going back to everyone seeing this as linear, I think if you just view this as a machine that breaks down and then you just have to start it back up, then you're like, whatever, we just wait 2 months. Like, sure, some people will lose their house or whatever, but that's worth getting Trump out. And then we'll just get the key out and we'll turn it back on, not realizing that, you started all these processes that take, years to undo. But yeah, I think there's every day we get closer to the election, the Democrats have less incentive to give on this. And I think they've known that all along. And I've been, saying, to clients all along, like they have the leverage here. Republicans are going to have to meet them, not the other way around. So it's been clear to me Republicans had to at least go to 1.5 or 2 trillion. And from a pure political standpoint, if they want to win the election, they should want to go to that high, because that would, dramatically increase their chances of holding the Senate and the White House. But it's kind of not in the cards. They were willing to do the emergency one, early on, but I think so many of them thought everything would be okay after that, like, because they had a wait and see approach. Like, let's see what this first round does. It'll probably fix everything and we won't have to do much. And I think a significant number of them thought, hey, we're doing good. Look, we're growing, 20%, like we were just talking about, like huge numbers. V-shaped recovery, that's all everyone's talking about. S&P is making a new all-time high. Like, we probably don't need to spend $2 trillion. When you look at the S&P making a new high and you say, like, we have to spend $2 trillion or we're screwed, that sounds crazy. And in a way, the market's kind of held that back. I still think everyone on Wall Street expects a huge fiscal stimulus in the next 2 months, and it very well may not come. And if it does not come, the economy is going to deteriorate more than anyone envisions right now.
Yeah, well, and I think that that's the right. I mean, personally, I wouldn't normally make big portfolio moves for a period of time that's so short, because rest assured, whoever wins the election, they're gonna make it rain. Yes. Shortly thereafter. I mean, the spending spree is going to be off. The thing that worries me is when you are this detached from fundamentals. And, there's a guy out there by the name of Steve Saville that wrote an article that somebody sent some to me. And I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but good newsletter. And he was making the point that, yes, we are detached from fundamental definitions and fundamental valuation metrics. But he goes, we're not detached in the sense that when you flood a system with this much paper, you would expect asset prices to rise, even though that there's no economic or foundational reason behind them rising that way. And I totally agree with that.
Sure.
But when you look at, again, It is justifiable only on the basis of the amount of money being spent. And when you look at that money being contracted, and you look at all the setups, right, the gyrations we're seeing in volatility, the record divergence for the put-call ratio, you look at all these different things. And the thing that's concerning to me is, again, like I was saying, I wouldn't reposition my portfolio for a 2.5 month period of time where I could see some gyrations. The problem I've got is that you are so detached from any type of historical valuation metric or whatever, that a bumpy ride between here and election day could easily equate to another 30 to 35% drop, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely could, especially there's so much, like dead wood piled up now,
right.
Because no one has, we were talking about the put call ratio earlier. Because no one has that insurance taken out right now, there will be a scramble, another kind of liquidity event, another scramble for insurance. And, if you're not just cashing in your puts, that means you have to start selling stuff to get out of the way. And that, becomes very much a self-reinforcing move lower, which is exactly, what we saw, February, March, whenever we had the big move. And I do think the conditions are there for another just giant move lower, and mostly because people don't have a lot of protection on from what we can tell.
Well, and you know, the other thing too, and this is completely anecdotal, so, you know, don't take this to the bank by any stretch of the imagination, because I'm not, and, you know, to the listeners, that is. But, you know, you don't, like we were saying earlier, you don't want to step in front of this freight train, but, you know, all my spidey senses are going, I mean, just nobody, you can't be a bear. Right. I mean, you've been taken to the woodshed multiple times. You've been skinned, you've been hung up to dry, all that kind of stuff. Right. There are guys still out there griping about it and saying, that, you know, and me, myself included. Right. Like, I'm sitting there, you know, nervous as a cat on a hot tin roof. But also, you know, if you look at my portfolio, we've got a lot of long exposure. You know, we've got some protective hedges in there as well. But I mean, you can't not be long. Yet at the same time, just from doing this for a while, I mean, the setup here for a sharp pullback, it's textbook, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, like you're saying, you have to be long, and you have to have been long lately. And that's, in my opinion, the beauty of y'all's portfolio is you guys have some, you know, trend following overlay that's just built in. And, you know, on a fundamental basis, you know, you go back to April, there was nothing fundamentally saying other than, you know, money printing. But there was nothing about the economy that said you better go out and buy a bunch of stocks. But, you know, if you have an algorithm out there that takes trend into account, it's going to buy. And though, you know, having that protects you from yourself on the upside and the downside. And that's been a huge help. And yeah, that's sort of the way I just trade to begin with is, you know, hey, if something starts breaking out, like, especially honestly, especially if I don't understand it and it's breaking out, I should probably buy it. You know, then you have risk control. You have a stop loss. You know where you're going to get out, and you know maybe you buy protection against it. But at the same time, like, you have to have at least some sort of a trend overlay. And you know, you let that take itself out. You don't take it out. And so if we do fall 35%, and you know you get stopped out at 7, then you just saved a ton of money on that downside. But, you know, you were there to ride just a historic rip higher, you know. It's gonna be an interesting fall because of everything, you know, we just talked about. I do expect there to be some heartburn, but I don't know if that's like a vicious 2-day 10% move and then we kind of clear it out and we're good to go. Or, you know, that 30% move, or, you know, kind of a slow grinding move lower. It'll really depend on, you know, the policy response.
Well, and yeah, and I think this is a valuable topic for listeners to be able to hear, because I think kind of puts you inside the mind of people that manage money for a living. There is no certainty. There is no guru out there with the answers. I've said that before on the show a million times. If you're looking for them, you're not going to find it here, and you're not going to find it anywhere. But that is what it was so interesting about this setup is when you're talking about, you know, outcome ranges, right? In this certain setup, I mean, I don't think I've ever been able to look at a market before and sit there and say, you know, I could see under the right circumstances, I mean, some things would have to go wrong, right? But I could see us finishing the market, you know, finishing this year with the S&P at, you know, 2,300, you know, potentially. I could easily see us finishing here with the S&P at 4,000.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that both outcomes are probably, I don't think either of those things are tail events. You know what I mean? I think both of those things are in the heart of the bell-shaped curve. I don't think they're tails.
Right. Yeah, the cone of uncertainty is just so wide lately.
Well, and that's the incredible thing to me is that that is what is so unique. You know, that is what is different this time, is that to see this level of euphoria with this level of uncertainty, there really are no historical comps, are there?
I not that I can think of off the top of my head. I can think of some, you know, periods like when we went off the gold standard and everyone's like, oh, that's terrible. And then stocks ripped, you know, that kind of threw people off. But you know that you can easily draw a line to that it makes perfect sense. But
in retrospect, yeah, it makes.
But I'm just trying to think of something historically where like you just had no idea what was coming next, and
no one cared. And again, I think we've spoken about this before on the show, but really the only market environment you can compare this to, and in so many ways, the vast majority of ways, this is even wilder than it was in '99. But the difference is you're going to have GDP down somewhere between 8 to 10% this year. You know what? I should ask you. So let me finish this, and then I'd like to hear what you're expecting out of GDP, because maybe I'm a little bit over bearish on that. But so you've got the only thing you can really comp to is the height of the tech bubble. Yet in 99, GDP expanded by 4.1%. This year will be the biggest contraction in a single year since the Great Depression.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, and it's going to be that way, you know. And the other thing that's kind of important here is, like, tech bubble, like, that stung in America, but, you know, wasn't a big global thing. Like, we've really never had an event like this where even worse than the Great Depression, as far as the percentage of countries that are in a recession, it's never been really higher, like, in modern history. So this is a global thing, you know. Our GDP for the last quarter was horrendous, and it was better than basically everyone in Europe. And that's despite COVID being worse here. So it is just a brutal global, you know, phenomena.
Yeah. Well, okay. So getting to the GDP numbers, I mean, you and I have discussed earnings. You know, who knows? Maybe they're not going to come quite in as bad as that. Quite as bad as I've projected. I still looking at the numbers though, and I for the life of me, I mean, just the math, I cannot get to some of these earnings projections where you got these guys that are, you know, that are really sticking by their 15 to 20% dip in earnings this year. And I just can't get there. We've discussed that. I think you and I are on the same page. You can correct me if we're not. What do you see on GDP? Where do you think that we'll finish the year? How big of a hit is this going to be?
So just to be clear, I have absolutely no idea. If I had to guess, I would say something around like 7%, but I honestly have no idea. I don't really spend any time, you know, trying to figure out what GDP is going to do, you know, on a granular level.
Well, because it's turned into such an arbitrary number, right? I mean, you know,
oh, yeah.
A stimulus bill here and there can completely flip it upside down. So,
right? Yeah, it's going to be bad, and it's going to take. What's important is probably the time spent to get back to, you know, kind of where we were in the fourth quarter of 2020. That's what's important to me anyways, for the way I analyze the market. And
2019,
I think that, yeah, sorry, 2019. And I think it's going to take a considerable amount of time. And I think that's where the problem is whenever you consider, you know, the debt levels that we have and the money it takes to service debt. And, you know, then you try to figure out, like, you know, as an economy and as, you know, individual businesses that are doing less, but came into this with, you know, really high debt levels, like that is just a massive problem. That's why you see, you know, the fact that we have that 40% default rate, you know, and triple C's, like, by my math, we've definitely had at least 100,000 small businesses already closed, and that's going to just keep, you know, blasting higher. And people forget that's like half of employment right there to small businesses. I don't see getting back to those highs of Q4 of 19 on GDP for years. And that's just as important to me, you know, as whether we finish the year down 5% or 10% of GDP.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, like we were saying, I mean, I think in a lot of different ways, I think that's turned into somewhat of an arbitrary metric anyway, just because it can be.
But everyone watches it, so we have to watch it. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's, we got to know what everybody else knows, right? Yeah. You got to play that game. So when we look out, the thing that I'm trying to get my head around is that I don't really see any way that they can stem the tide of the foreclosures. I don't see how they can stem the tide of the bankruptcies. I guess you could have a scenario. Do you have to get the underlying economy coming along to keep this thing rolling? Or, I mean, you know, cause like we said, they're going to stimulate again. We're going to get another stimulus package. The buy the dip muscle has been it is so strong, and it's been so right. Right. So one of the other things I think about is any dip will just be another reason for another rally too. Especially after this year. Are we all just in the dark here? Do you have any insights or any thoughts as to where we are going as far as markets are related and how much longer this thing can run?
So my guess is that we do end up rolling over this fall and having some problems that will kind of put the impetus on stimulus coming through, whether that's, you know, just before the election or we feel a lot of pain going into the election, and then we get the stimulus. You know, we are going to get it. We're going to get massive fiscal help again, and at that point, it will make sense to buy the dip. And I'll go from, you know, buying a bunch of volatility to you know, cashing that in and moving on to do something else at that point. And then, yeah, the market's going to head higher because why wouldn't it at that point?
So,
it's that simple, honestly, right now.
No, I know. And I just keep, like I said, it's, you know, there's sometimes it's, you know, I've mentioned this on the show before. Sometimes it is frustrating just because, you know, you're looking at this and you're thinking, and, you know, in normal times, I probably wouldn't have more than 10% equity exposure in a scenario like this. Yet at the same time, you know, we all see what's happening. I mean, you got to, you know, like we were saying, you got to play the game in front of you. Your job's to make money. I'm just wondering what the amplitude of this thing can keep going. And I guess if you're stimulating and you're going to keep doing what they're doing and do MMT light, or, you know, depending on the election outcome, you could even get MMT heavy.
Right.
You know, how much higher can it go? Any thoughts on gold and the precious metal space? I say that because, you know, I think by far that's been our biggest winning position this year. We got a little lucky on timing during the downturn and sort of bottom ticked the miners on accident, you know, which is, you and I both know, if you top tick something or bottom tick something, you might be convinced that you're a genius, but most likely there was it was serendipitous to some level.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's been a smoking trade, obviously. I've been involved in gold markets for a long time. Gold's making me a little nervous here. Am I being too paranoid, or what are you seeing? What are you thinking?
No, so this is tough short term. So in my opinion, everything is very, very difficult in the next week or so. So something I've been looking forward is kind of the reflation trade that's going on, you know, all these commodities ripping and, you know, we're seeing it in precious metals, inflation expectations kind of keep creeping higher, and that's making real interest rates, you know, interest rates adjusted for inflation, have gotten like -1. If you look at like about 10 year, I think that's going to start unwinding itself. I think a lot of people are convinced we have real inflation right now, and because of the stimulus, same thing that, you know, is making the market go up. And I don't think that's true. I think this, we will get significant inflation in the next decade, but I don't think that's what we're seeing right now. And I think when the market realizes like, oh, this isn't real inflation, this is just kind of short term, like bottlenecks and policy response, you know, crazy stuff, inflation that's about to roll over, then I think you start seeing real rates kind of spike back higher. And that should, you know, cause a lot of pain for trades like precious metals. But at the same time, you know, something that would come along with that trade would be the dollar moving higher. And I've been waiting for that kind of all month, and we at least stopped collapsing, but, you know, we're kind of at the lows right now. So if I'm not right that the dollar is going to get a little bounce here in the next couple of weeks, then, you know, the metals are probably going to keep ripping higher. So I think short term caution is very much warranted. It's kind of a crowded trade. Everyone loves precious metals at the moment for the same reason, and everyone's long. So it's something I am personally very cautious about. You know, really for the last year, I was kind of loaded up long, short-term and long-term accounts and everything. And I've taken most of that, most of like the tactical exposure off. You know, I still have my core position because that's the anchor of my book. But moving forward short-term, I'm definitely nervous about metals. If, you know, if it keeps going up and my core position goes up, I'll be fine. But I'm happy to sit out the next move higher if I have to, because I think the risk is significant short term.
Yeah, we were just to give you an idea, we were at about I think we're up to about 19% minor exposure when we were at 2050 gold, and we've now pulled that back to 11, so we've almost cut it by 50%. And I'm watching it like a hawk because I'm very much considering peeling that back to even a 6 to 7% position of the portfolio. You know, and then if we can break out above, you know, 2050 and make new highs in the price of gold, then I could always jump back in there. But that's exactly the way we're going about it right now, is just holding on to our core position, not being. And then the other side of it, too, if you're out there and you've been playing the miners this year, you've gotten a heck of a rip. And the last thing on earth, again, in this market now, would I rather own miners than all these tech companies? Of course I would. But I also know that I'm operating in a market that's completely unhinged. And I have zero desire to give back half of that profit that we've made on miners this year. You know, you just don't want to. You just don't want to give that back. And I think playing it close to the vest on miners at this point is probably the best way forward. And then, you know, the other piece of advice I'd give people is don't try to get things perfect. You won't. Right. You know, if you miss out on a few percent here and you guard against giving back 40 or 50% of the profits you booked, that's a good trade. You know, you just gotta, you don't want to give it all back.
Speak on that real quick. Something I talk about a lot, is dimmer switch trading versus light switch trading. For whatever reason, people want a light switch. They want to be all in or all out, but the best approach is to trade around, you know, if it's something you love, trade around a core position. So, put a third on and then put another third on, another third, and then take them off whenever it, you know, if something you bought is going straight up. You know, to me, it always makes sense to take a little bit off and put it in your pocket.
Yeah, we did that the other day. We bought a stock that hit a target we were watching. It was a trade. It was a short-term trade for us. I bought it at the market open at about 117, 118. Within 3 hours, it was at 146.
Yeah, I mean,
on relatively no news. I mean, it wasn't anything. And that same day, we got up the next morning. It pulled back a little bit, bounced back up, and I took it. We were in the trade for less than 24 hours because you're just like, you know, we thought it could run to 145 was our target, and it just hit it, you know, within hours. You know, you gotta, you know, when you're riding something, especially like you said, that if it's not a strong conviction part of your portfolio, you know, take the money. Now that kind of goes counter to what you were just saying, because that is light switch trading. But, you know, light switch trading, the one time where I think that that's acceptable is when you are just, it's simply a short-term trade where you see an opportunity.
Right, very tactical. Exactly.
Yeah. But other than that, I think you're dead on about the dimmer switch trading. Now, anything else going on in the market that's really caught your, that's really caught your eye?
Yes.
Okay. Hit me.
Agriculture. Agriculture is starting to impress me. And now I trade futures, and there's not easy ways to kind of get exposure to these markets outside of futures. Well, they're easy, but they're not particularly efficient, but, there are ETFs for like corn, wheat, soybeans, they're not great vehicles to buy and hold, stay in long term. They're definitely trading vehicles because they have exposure to futures roll, which, you know, just kind of bleeds you out. But corn, wheat, soybeans, coffee, sugar, cocoa, like there's a lot of, and soybean oil, soybean meal, cotton, like pretty much you name it in the agriculture space. That's kind of where all my money in the futures is right now. And you're not getting enough rain in the Midwest at the moment, and you're getting too much rain in places like China. So that's having a kind of dramatic supply and demand impact all of a sudden. If China keeps having these flooding problems in their, you know, kind of agricultural areas, they're definitely going to have to start buying just unbelievable amounts of agricultural commodities from the US, which will do wonders for, you know, kind of supply overhangs.
What is the impact that this Three Gorges Dam could have? And then have you looked into that at all? Where are we at as far as the stability of that thing or the viability of that thing? And then how big of an impact could that have on that agricultural play if that dam were to give?
So if it did, first of all, I have just less than no idea whether, you know, the dam holds or not. I'm not even going to speculate.
You're not going to put your Twitter engineering.
Yeah, I've seen so much of that, and it drives me crazy. Yeah, but if it did, you know, the impact would be very dramatic because downriver, and you know, even if that thing stays up, this is like horrible, like, you know, once in a century flooding. So it's already having the impact you need for the catalyst for agriculture. But yeah, if the dam broke, you know, it would be just a horrendous event, you know, as far as lives lost, property damage, and it would, you know, be a big deal to their agricultural heartland. And it's not just, everyone focuses on the Yangtze River where that dam is, but if you look at like kind of the, I think it's like 5-6 biggest, you know, most important rivers in China, they're all flooding. It's not just that river. So this is a big deal. And you know, even without that, I think it's going to keep having an impact on agricultural prices, but things like corn, you know, just not getting enough rain in the Midwest all of a sudden is causing problems, even though it's kind of late in the year. You know, a lot of the corn's kind of already, you know, largely grown, but even this late in that cycle, if you have no rain, you start having, you know, a less and less of a crop yield this year. So I think that that's something that has definitely caught my eye lately, and it's the places I like to be. If we do get a liquidity event in the market and you start seeing, you know, those 5% down days in the S&P, the best place, in my opinion, to be, and this might not be true here soon because everyone's going to start buying these things, but the best place to be is be long something you like that won't get impacted by that and not everyone owns. Because if you're in something everyone owns, everyone's going to sell it to raise money. So like gold, if we had a liquidity event, everyone's going to sell their gold because they have to. Probably not a lot of people are going to be out selling their cotton futures. So, you know, if I'm out here long cotton and the fundamental story stays the same for cotton and the S&P selling off, I don't have to worry about, you know, every hedge fund in the world selling off their cotton because they don't own any to begin with.
Right.
That really served me well, you know, back in February. I was long nat gas and no one else was long nat gas. They were all shorting it. So nat gas didn't care that the stock market was limited down every day. It just kind of kept doing its thing. And that really helped me.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't. Trying to think if we had parts of the port. Well, we had hedges, so that's kind of what that 20% treasuries. I think we were 8% long vol and at about 12% leverage short on the NASDAQ. So we kind of played it. And one of the reasons I did chase is because I think if you can get involved in those kind of spaces and you can play in the futures game, I'm with you 100%. But one of the things that we've been saying for years, and again, it's one of those deals where it always cracks me up when guys make a prediction or a call and it comes true and they stick their chest out and they walk around and crow about it, you know, because whenever I make a prediction that comes true, I'm probably more shocked than the people that heard me make it, you know, just cause you know, the randomness of it all. Right.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's hard to predict, but one of the things that we'd been saying through this cycle was when this thing finally ends, short is going to become an asset class, meaning that I don't know if there's anywhere you can be in any type of size when these kind of things unravel that you're going to be safe other than just to be short. And sure enough, you know, through that downturn that we had in March, you know, I had to move things around because the only way to keep any type of balance in the portfolio was just you had to have a substantial short position. You just had to have that buoy to hold you up. So in closing, and I know you're a busy guy, we got to let you run, but, is there anything else that you think we need to be aware of? I know you've been on Nat Gas. Any thoughts about where we go from Nat Gas from here? Anything else? I know you're playing the back months on volatility. I'm just trying to think if I want to squeeze every drop out of this while I got you on here.
Sure.
Final closing thoughts. You give a summation of anything else you think we need to know.
Yeah, you mentioned natural gas, and I still love natural gas, but, you know, my thesis is starting to, like, the reality is starting to catch up to it lately. So it's been doing well, which, you know, as things start to do well, it starts making me nervous. So,
yeah,
I will probably start, you know, taking a little bit of profits if we keep ripping here, you know, to hoping to, you know, deploy that back lower later. But I also love oil. I think oil could definitely have some problems the rest of this year. So short term, oil still has some headwinds. I think people are getting a little too excited. But if you look out in the next 5-10 years, I just think that the fundamental case for oil is as good as it could possibly be. So if people are just, you know, looking to put a couple of nickels into something that they're willing to hold for a decade, you know, and willing to have a lot of volatility, and I think looking at some of the really beaten up oil stocks is a good way to do that.
Yeah,
and I'm already there, but I'm waiting to, like, really deploy a lot of money until we get another pullback.
You know, which reminds me, and I say this cautiously because, you know, there have been times where I thought this in the past in this cycle. Right now, I think I feel probably more conviction about this right now in this cycle. I think the most important thing right now, in my opinion, is what you are watching is, in my opinion, you are watching, you know, short-term thinking and short-term expectations ruling the day. And I, you know, if you want to know how to get through something like this intact, like you said, go to the places that people aren't. The other thing is, you know, kind of be that contrarian, right? But force yourself to do what nobody is doing right now, which is thinking long-term. Right. And keep in mind that we are managing money to build wealth over time. We are not managing money to make as much as we can before December 31st. And, you know, that is a simple, hard thing to do, because what it will mean is that as long as this goes on, relatively speaking, you probably will not have the performance. You know, go look at oil stocks, right? Oil stocks are down. The ones we own are down, you know, between 13 and 20% in the last month and a half or so. And in that period of time, oil went from like 38 to 43, you know, you're like, okay. And I think that's just a factor of, you know, all the weak hands getting shooken out and people selling and putting it into NVIDIA and, you know, Apple. You know what I mean? I just fundamentally, right. There's no reason for those stocks to be dropping.
It's people chasing performance, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I, in my opinion, I think long-term thinking right now is the prescription, and it will be painful. Or, you know, here's the other thing. You don't have to do it all one way or the other, right? You can have a 25 to 30% portion of the portfolio that is the short-term position. Or the short-term right. thinking part of it. Just keep an eye on the risk and manage those things. But I think right now you're right. As bad as so much of this looks, and as ridiculous as so much of these prices are, if you're looking at longer-term, more classical types of investments, there are some opportunities out there, right?
Absolutely. And in my opinion, most of those, and we talk about this every time I'm on, I think, but most of those really great opportunities, they're in real assets. You know, they're, yep. they're in natural resources, type environments, and specialty kinds of real estate that no one else, everyone knows, like office space and apartments are in trouble, but you know, there's telecom real estate and data center real estate. There's, you know, mobile home real estate. There's all these the kind of interesting pockets of real estate that you can be involved in that are, you know, farmland, that aren't so tied to, you know, where we're at right now, that, you know, some of those are undervalued or underappreciated. Some of them pay huge yields. So there's a lot of interesting places to deploy money right now that aren't crazy overvalued the way, you know, big tech is.
Yep. Yep. And it is too. Saw a headline the other day that U.S. tech stocks are now valued more highly than the entire European market.
That's something else. Yeah.
You
look at like how much Tesla is, you know, worth almost every other car company combined, and those kinds of numbers are special.
Yeah, no, it is. And I was saying, I think I said that last week on the show, like, you know, be skeptical because this is crazy. At the same time, take a step back and, you know, you're watching financial history. You know, Doug Kass, Seabreeze Partners, wrote an article making the argument that Tesla very well could be the biggest single stock bubble of all time. You know, just saying that
makes sense to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, there are companies out there that are more highly valued, right? Or in terms of, you know, their valuation that are a little more crazy, but not when you consider what they do. And everybody's answer is, well, Tesla's, they're not a car company, they're a tech company. And I go, okay, well, tell that to their balance sheet, right? Because right. if you look at their income statement, 100% of their income comes from selling cars. So until that is not the
case. Their sales are down year over year.
Yeah. Right. And their sales are down year over year. So you can call it whatever you want, but if you all 100% of your revenue comes from selling cars, you're not a tech company.
Right? Exactly.
I mean, you know,
you may have cool tech and they do, but your money's made selling cars.
Yeah. Well, and the other aspect of why you're not a tech company is that all these SaaS companies, all these tech companies that have these monstrous valuations, it's because they're not capitally intensive businesses.
Exactly.
You make a one-time investment and then you keep reaping, you know, it's like I've equated it to building a turnstile. You spend the money to build the turnstile, and then really only you got is some maintenance fees, and that baby just keeps kicking you out revenue, right? Yep. Tesla cannot realize a dime of revenue without a capital of investment in excess of $40,000. Right? I mean, that's
exactly.
That's the way it is. Anyway, all right, pal. Well, I appreciate you joining us and giving us a macro update, giving us a breakdown, and it really helps. Keep an eye on things for us. Make sure you let us know if there's anything else that we need to be paying attention to. In the meantime, happy trading. Make sure you take care of that daughter of yours, and we'll hope to get you back on soon.
All right. Look forward to it. Appreciate you having me on.
All right, pal. Have a good one. And guys, okay, we got to end it right here. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we will be back next week. Got another great interview on tap that I don't want you to miss. Not going to tell you who it is. We got to do the tease here. You got to tune in to hear it. But anyway, got another great interview on tap. Somebody we haven't had on in a while. And I think it's going to be a great person to get an update from. So anyway, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH and 97.3 Cairo FM.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.